Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 150. Tibetan Medicine 101. Buddha's Barefoot Doctors.
In a way, I guess you could say Tibetans had the first barefoot doctors in the 17th century, because these paintings are the earliest, according to scholars, the earliest illustrated medical atlas. There's 77 of them. There's only about 30 in this room, but we have a total of 77 here and there, down in the spa here and there. And they're sort of a teaching device for someone maybe who's semi-literate. It's, you know, the reason for it. They're illustrating a set of works by Fifth Dalai Lama's spiritual son called Desi Sangye Gyatso, very brilliant 17th century personage, called Blue Beryl, which beryl being, I think beryl, anybody is a gemologist here? I think a beryl is a sapphire, it's a beryl, ruby, emerald, topaz, these are all beryls. It's a type of crystal name. Is that right? You're nodding like you know that. Good.
From jewelry.
What?
From jewelry.
Oh, from my work?
No, from jewelry.
Oh, jewelry, good, I'm glad. This is why, you know, this beryl by Durya people wrongly translate the medicine Buddha's stone color as lapis lazuli, which is opaque. But beryls are translucent, although the dark blue is hard to, of course, see through unless it's a very light sapphire. So therefore, I always use sapphire for as a sapphire radiance of the medicine Buddha, rather than lapis. But everyone else uses lapis for Vaidurya. Although Indranila in Sanskrit also means lapis, and Vaidurya is translated as a beryl, and lapis is not a beryl at all. So that in case you see medicine Buddha things where they talk about the lapis lazuli radiance, etc., you know, lapis lazuli is a dark blue that's opaque, you know, and it doesn't make sense. I hope. I'm ready to stand corrected, but I think read sapphire for lapis when you read that. Then you did Tara, right? Then everyone did Tara, green Tara.
Green Tara.
And you have a short sadhana for that green Tara. And you have a sadhana for the medicine Buddha with the eight Buddhas stacked up on top of your head. And slowly dissolving one into the other and into yourself as you read out the salutations to those eight Buddhas. That's very good. I do have a friend who had an intestinal cancer and didn't want to do any operation, and he did so and so many prostrations to the medicine Buddha with one Lama and mentor of his, teacher of his, Geshe, for 6 months, and he went into remission, I must say. I have other cases that I've heard of that haven't worked, but that one did work. So good luck with that. And if you're in the healing profession, I think the medicine Buddha practice, and as much as you can learn about the medicine Buddha and so on, I think it's really marvelous. I think, obviously, I'm inspired by medicine Buddha. Did I tell the story when I was a young would-be monk, a novice monk, in Dharamsala, 1964, I was under the tutelage of His Holiness Dalai Lama. That's 50 years ago. I can't believe it. It's like this time, by the way, in case any of you younger ones think you have a lot of time. At the end of it, it's like this. Anyway, and it speeds up as it goes along. And, you know, I was into studying Madhyamaka those days, especially more than Tantra. I had some initiations, and I would keep up, you know, the short sadhanas. But I was especially into Shunyata, you know, and studying Madhyamaka, Nagarjuna's writing, Tsongkhapa's writing. on that. I was 23 years old, 23. And my Mongolian teacher showed up, my original sort of root mentor, my spiritual parent, a 63-year-old Mongolian Lama from the Kalmyk Nation. And he said he showed up with Amji Yishi Danden. And Yishi Danden is still alive. He's very elderly now. He was the Dalai Lama's personal physician at that time, and also a Tibetan physician. And also he was reestablishing the Menzikang, that is the Astrology and Medicine Institute of His Holiness in Dharamsala, which was a reestablishment of the one in Lhasa that the fifth Dalai Lama had established. And the fifth had established Chakpuri, up on top of a mountain where there's now a Chinese television broadcaster, because they destroyed that entire building, the Chakpuri, the Iron Mountain, on the hill across from the Potala in Lhasa. And then the 13th Dalai Lama established in Lhasa City, near the Barkhor, near the Jokhang Cathedral, he established the Lhasa Menzikang in the 1910s and 20s. So this was being reestablished in Dharamsala by Yishi Danden. So my Mongolian Geshe-la, Danjile Tsenimete Geshe Wangel, Lawang Wangel, he shows up with this guy who is the most amazing looking guy. He has these big cheekbones. He still does, big cheekbones, but he was thinner and younger then, so they're more prominent. And then the ears are an exact line of the cheekbones. And he really does look like a Garuda. A Garuda, which is like patron of medicine, you know, and also you find often behind the Buddha's throne, you find a Garuda holding snakes in his mouth, symbolizing his dominance of poisons and also control of Nagas, things like that. And what's the matter?
Chipmunk.
What?
Chipmunk.
Oh, we have a chippy inside?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, he'll go out, I guess. Okay, and so he said, he comes with Yishi Danden, and he says to me in Tibetan, I mean, the Geshe Wangyal does, he says, you study Tibetan medicine with this man. And I said, in English, not to be rude, I said, I don't want to study Tibetan medicine. I'm studying shunyata, you know, meditate. I want to attain enlightenment. He says, you worry about enlightenment later. Now you study Tibetan medicine with this man. So I did. And I learned to read the pulses. I memorized the Zadyu. I memorized the Zado. That is the Pulse Sutra, it's called in the final Tantra. And I had to read the pulses of thousands of patients, mostly Indians, but a lot of Tibetans also, ahead of the Yishi Danden. Once I learned the Pulse Sutra, I had to read those pulses and give my diagnosis. Of course, you look at them also, you ask questions, but then you listen to the pulse. I look at urine, you know, stir urine. I had to do that first while he observed, and then I would say something, then he would criticize what I said. and then subsequent to that, I was only a year or so doing that. And then I had to return to the States. And then I always kept a very fond place for Tibetan medicine. And it was helped me in my life and with my family. It was always gave me a second opinion to whatever the Western doctors said. And a beautiful system. And also the mind-body aspect of it is beautiful. And the way in which it cultivates the compassion of the physician, and it makes compassion as an absolute sine qua non, like an absolute prerequisite for a healing person. In addition to, you know, for the lay person to, you know, relate to the Tibetan, the medicine Buddha whenever they feel ill or whatever, you know, and help others with that, others who are ill, and we're often ill, all of us, you know. So it is a really great tradition, the medicine Buddha tradition. It's really something magical and marvelous. There's a work by a man named Kenneth Zisk, Z-Y-S-K, called something like Asceticism and Medicine in Ancient India, or something like that. I'm sorry, I'm not remembering exact title, but it's a pretty unusual name. And of course, it has all its scholarly caveats and hedges, but basically, He was a scholar of Ayurveda medicine, you know, the Charaka Samhita and the Indian Ayurveda tradition. And then he did some research, and then he sort of, if he was less kind of like worried about being scholarly, non-committal and uncertain about everything, his thesis would be phrased that the medicine in India was really distributed by the Buddhist monasteries and by the Buddhist monks. It was a special Buddhist monk knowledge. There are some special accounts in the history of the Sangha of the Buddha telling the monks to take care of such and such a monk who he found all covered with, you know, vomit and in a very terrible state. The other monks were ignoring him. And the special thing about how they should take care of each other and they should know about medicine and so on. And also the Buddhist monks, because they, when they entered into the Buddhist community and the nuns, they left their caste. So it became a place in Indian society where the caste system was ignored, and therefore it was an eroder of the rigidity of the caste system within Indian society. And whereas the Brahmins who controlled the Ayurveda, and even the word Ayurveda is significant, because Ayu is the branch of the eight branches of Buddhist medicine, which has to do with longevity. And it's not the branch having to do with gynecology, with pediatrics, with dealing with poisons, with dealing with wounds in war, surgery. It's just longevity. So the fact that the Brahmins are interested in the longevity is significant in that their tradition, they call it Ayurveda. And they are weak in pediatrics. They didn't have urinalysis, for example, because they didn't want to get involved with unclean things. They wouldn't take that. They only have a thread around the wrist of a woman, holding the thread, so they wouldn't touch the wrist of the woman, and so on. And the Brahmin, you know, especially, and then they wouldn't touch and mess with lower caste people. So how would that spread a universal medical knowledge in a culture? It wouldn't. So that's, therefore, Zisk pursues that, and it's interesting for those of you interested in historically. And certainly in the history of Tibet, there's a famous story in a book published by the Wellcome Foundation in England called, I think it's just called Tibetan Medicine, and it has in it a biography of Yutok, the different Yutoks, who were the two Yutok Senior, Yutok Junior, who were the great doctors sort of who founded the tradition and rediscovered the medical tantras, as they call them, and maybe combine them with things, knowledge from Tibet and Mongolia and Persia and China, the thing that came from Buddhist medicine in India. But in that, there's a wonderful story about Gaji and Biji, Biji and Gaji. And Biji and Gaji were two, hi, there's a chair over here. There's an empty chair here. This one. Probably can only sit in one chair at a time. And Biji and Gaji were two Indian physicians, Buddhist physicians, who were visiting Tibet before Buddhism came to Tibet. I think in the time of Lhasa Thodol, there's a Tibetan tradition that in the time of that king, of that emperor, of the Tibetan conquest dynasty, some books came by levitation onto the roof of his palace, Sanskrit books, the Avalokiteshvara, Omani Pema Hum book, and a couple of others. And no one could read them, so, you know, because it was in Sanskrit, so, but they treated them as sacred objects. So it was around that time, you know, and then they were began to think about Buddhist Indian thing, peaceful thing, because they were still warriors. Anyway, Biji and Gaji came upon a young woman and her grandmother at a cave site out in the woods, or not maybe just in the hills, in central Tibet, and they were both weeping. And so Gaji and Biji said, "Why are you weeping? What's the problem? You look perfectly okay." And they said, "Well, we're weeping because I'm leaving Granny here in the cave because she's too old and she's been ill and she can't do any productive work. And, you know, we live a subsistence level around here. And that's our tradition when someone reaches a certain age." So then Biji and Gaji, they said, "This is barbaric. That's like, you know, wolves and do that, you know, with their elderly and wild animals, not humans." "Well, what can I do? The village won't take her back. You know, that's why we're crying, you know." So they said, "Well, look, I tell you what, if we treated your grandmother, we're doctors. And if we treated her and she became strong and well and could continue her productive work in the village, would they be happy to have her back? Yes, absolutely. Great. What can you do? So then they treated her, and then whatever it was wrong with her, they healed it very quickly. Wasn't too serious with their knowledge of herbs and whatever. And then she went back happily to the village, and everybody was happy. And this story came to the emperor, and he really liked that idea. And so he summoned them to the royal court somewhere in distant, and then made them physicians and so forth. And then, so in other words, you have an instance of the medical tradition preceding the Dharmic knowledge, and the people in the country, top down in that kind of case, taking a real interest in the Dharma, in the Buddha Dharma, because the Buddhists had a better knowledge of the human body and the herbs and nature and whatever, you know, sickness and health. And there's one of the oldest temples in Japan is the Yakushiji. I think it's in Kyoto area, I forget actually, or Nara area. And the Yakushiji is a, Yakushi is Menla, medicine Buddha in Japanese. And similarly, some empress was cured by some Korean doctor or something, and then they made a temple to Yakushi, you know, the medicine Buddha. Yao Shufo is a Chinese, and that's the medicine Buddha in China. Yakusa in Korea, and some of the earliest temples. In Korea, the usual, I learned this in visiting Korea a couple of years ago, and the usual tableau in most Buddhist temples is Shakyamuni Buddha. There are three Buddhas usually, and there'll be Shakyamuni Buddha in the middle, and on the left or right, I can't remember, maybe on the right, Amitabha, you know, Pure Land. That's the important Pure Land school for East Asia. It's very, very important, and was, I'm sure, in India in ancient time. You know, that's sort of going to heaven for the layperson, you know, so it's really important. And then Medicine Buddha. So, you know, it isn't Maitreya, and then the old Kashyapa and Shakyamuni, like the three times Buddhas, or Manjushri and Maitreya, like in some, you know, in Tibet. It's Buddha, Obame, and Medicine Buddha, and Menla, and everywhere in Korea. So it's been a major thing with the tradition. And this relates to this place, this center here, and perhaps the Lama Sopa in the Foundation for Preservation of Mahayana Tradition. He has a place called Land of Medicine Buddha in California. But he doesn't do Tibetan medicine there. I don't know why. But he does the sort of yoga of it, or his people do. But he doesn't have a Tibetan doctor there. If I had the funds of a Dharma center, we would definitely have all full-time Tibetan doctors here, absolutely. We'd capture Gela. Gela could never escape.
Never rest.
But we just don't have the funds, you know, to support him and his family, or the doctors in New York who really like Dr. Punzor. When we originally got this place, it was given to us. You know, we couldn't have bought it. It was just given to us, lock, stock, and barrel, to make a healing center. And I immediately brought some Tibetan doctors, but against my wife's better, my better half's better judgment, because we didn't have the funds to really support them. So I had to let them go back to New York after a little while, you know, which was, you know, they understood that. And they like, anyway, being with them. You know, there's not enough Tibetans in this area. The Tibetans like to live where there's a lot of other Tibetans. You know, they can make momo and thamba and whatever, you know. And they have a lot of clients among the other Tibetans. But anyway, this place, the goal of this place, because you have to realize this belongs to Tibet House U.S., which His Holiness asked us to form, and His Holiness is a patron of, and his personal secretary is on the board of, and all this. So it's really something at the request, express request of His Holiness, the Tibet House is. And the reason for us to seek a place where we can implement Tibetan healing and Tibetan medicine is that when I was asked by His Holiness to take charge of Tibet, of this, you know, his cultural institution in the U.S., I complained that, you know, I didn't know how I could preserve Tibetan culture being neither rich nor famous, merely a professor. And he said, you'll manage, etc. And I was feeling very stressed out. And this was in Dehradun in India. And at the time, and then that night I had this dream. And in the dream it all came together. My original guru forcing me to study Tibetan medicine, my love for it, and subsequent many, many years of translating for the Tibetan doctor and traveling around the world and, you know, translating for him, seeing patients and this, that sort of thing. And therefore respect for that tradition. and the preservation of the culture, because who's going to finally really preserve Tibetan culture? Tibetans, right? Now, Tibetans are exiles, or their own culture is being culture-sided in China. Nothing personal, it's not a personal thing. It's that China, you have to understand that China knows that after 1947, founding of UN, you're not supposed to go in and conquer and annex other countries that you didn't own before, you know, that's to prevent another world war, you know. That's why what Putin has done is very serious, you know, breaking the existing boundaries. And that's why Saddam Hussein was driven out of Kuwait, et cetera, et cetera. So they, even though the Red Chinese were not in the UN at the time, 1949 when they invaded, and 50 when they invaded Tibet, they know that you're not supposed to invade and occupy and annex anybody else's country. And they know they weren't in Tibet before 1949-50. They had absolutely no sway and no control in Tibet whatsoever, ever. Two dynasties that conquered China, the Mongolian and the Manchu, also had a protectorate relationship with Tibet. But no Chinese dynasty ever had such a protectorate relationship. So in international legal law, they have no business occupying Tibet. The whole plateau, that means, not just Tibet Autonomous Region. So therefore, they have a stake, you know, as a policy decision, to eliminate the Tibetans, to reclaim their country at any future date, if you follow me, under international law. And therefore, Tibetan culture is a threat because it proves that they don't have Chinese culture and they're not Chinese. Do you follow? So this has just been going on then for 64 years now. And it's a sad in a way, if they really did have a claim to Tibet, they might be more relaxed and nicer to the Tibetans. You know, that's why the Dalai Lama says, look, forget about history, we'll be part if you just give us a break. But they don't trust that because they know Dalai Lama's not lying, but they just know that eventually if the case is ever examined, ever at any time, that they're just completely off the wall. And they will make an analogy that, well, you killed all your Indians, you know, you're not giving back the U.S. to them, so why should we? And, you know, the answer is like wrong century, guys. There was no UN then, there was no CNN, there was no nothing, and also we are not living then, and we wouldn't have liked to do that. Few people in America didn't like that at the time. You know, there are treaties that they have, like large sections of New York State, the Black Hills, the Hopi land they still have, big, huge parts of Alaska, Oklahoma, Seattle, Georgia, you know. And they've just been robbed again and again, but, you know, they have their claims. And some of us someday, some fully honest president someday will honor them if they can control the Supreme Court and the Congress. So, anyway, I'm sorry to digress. But therefore, I had this dream vision that forced to study this, using the Tibetan medicine, then asked to preserve the culture, to head the institution that preserves the culture. The key thing is then we have to make Tibetan medicine known worldwide and valued as a sort of interesting matrix poised in between of the Ayurveda and the Chinese medicine, with acupuncture medicine, which is pretty famous. The old Persian medicine has just emerged as modern industrial medicine with the Hippocratic Oath and everything, but it's still there underlying. The urinalysis comes from Persia, from Greek medicine, from Galen, actually. And then whatever knowledge the Central Asian nomads and Mongolians and Tibetans have by ancient herbal knowledge, which is something really real and valid, actually, in the world, contrary to what commercial pharmaceutical people try to tell you. And so by making Tibetan medicine known and valued in the world, it will give Tibetans a reason to study it and to practice it and to really become masters of it. And then they will realize that by learning their own culture, they can thrive in the world. Do you follow me? That's the whole chain of reasoning. Yeah. Do you understand, Gila? Yeah. So that's what we're doing here in a way. Although it's not that narrow, we're trying to have the medicine Buddha, we're trying to create a platform from which medicine Buddha can reach into the guts of industrial medicine. I don't call it modern, I call it industrial medicine or commercial medicine. And try to introduce some more humane aspects and some more holistic worldview and et cetera, while not diminishing the analytic beauty of whatever they have discovered, but trying to get it out of the thing of just making money, you know, like operating on people right away. And the surgery is the 18th. You can see in these pictures incredibly sophisticated surgical implements. I'm not sure in this room, but in somewhere in our around. And so they had it, but it's the 18th thing you do out of 18 things. Not the first thing they do, you know, surgery. And we got good at surgery because of the wars, Civil War, World Wars, you know, then because of all our fighting, you know, putting people back together. And that's really great. And Tibetan medicine people really value our knowledge of surgery, but they do not appreciate overuse of it. I can tell you some stories about going on grand rounds in American hospitals with Yishi Dandan and him being appalled about some of the stuff they do, hacking people's lungs and this and that. And I won't even tell you some of them. But anyway, that's not, you know, one time, his last visit to the Worcester Hospital, UMass Hospital at Worcester, he said, "I'm not going back there ever again. It's not a hospital, it's a butcher shop," he said. And he meant it. He was a serious healer, you know, so. Overseeing some unnecessary operation being conducted and endangering the health of the people on whom they were being conducted. So, okay, so now what we studied together. So that's just my introduction to the day. Any question about medicine or Tibetan medicine? Are any of you studying Tibetan medicine other than the medicine Buddha yoga?
Starting.
No? You are?
Starting.
Oh, good. Are you a healing professional?
I am a psychologist.
You're a psychologist. Oh, good. So you're already an accredited healing professional of some kind. That's great. I think that's really exciting.
I have a question for you.
Yes?
On the topic that you're talking about, given that I'm not a Tibetan. I don't think anybody other in the room, other than Lama, is Tibetan. So we're really like the Tibetan stand-ins in a way, yes? To learn the Tibetan medicine and Menla ways, and to teach it and to practice it. So there's a global platform, yes?
Well, sort of, but...
Not to replace the Tibetans,
yeah,
but to facilitate that.
Yes,
platform.
To make it known and appreciated, you know, so any kind of effort in that direction will do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're at this stage, to really learn well Tibetan medicine, you really have to know the language. You know, you have to start, therefore, at the medical school level, I think, pretty much, to really do it. But to learn to appreciate it and to gain some aspect of some of its insights, and to reinforce your own natural compassion that you have as a healing professional, I'm sure you do, I can tell. And that's all to the good. And then maybe in some future instance, maybe working with a Tibetan physician, there are about 60 to 75 Tibetan physicians in North America, some of whom work in law offices, some of whom work in restaurants, some of them who don't, you know, who whatever, they work some other way. They don't use their knowledge except with their neighbors in the Tibetan communities, because they don't have a license and they don't know English that well. A few who come from China, and it's interesting, the Chinese, the one thing about Tibetan culture they didn't destroy was Tibetan medicine, because they value it very enormously. Mm-hmm. But in a way they did a little bit destroy its education, because they tried to strip out the medicine Buddha. They tried to treat it as a system of herbalism or something and get rid of medicine Buddha and anything spiritual for a while. But then since the 80s, it's kind of even that, they have ignored that and they let that back. And they haven't tried to persecute that. And so, but unfortunately, they've corrupted it and commercialized it a little bit within China. Mm. So that you can buy Tibetan pills or something in Shanghai for quite a high price that are not well made and not correct. You know, they're manufactured by some Chinese company with minimal Tibetan input and also harvesting things. And just, you know, like, cordyceps, like they strip harvest cordyceps and pay a lot of money for it and then use it as an invigorator without really using it in the matrix of the multiple herbal compounds that Tibetan doctors make, because they don't respect the Tibetan doctors that much. You know. So,
at UVA, they now made one of the Tibetan doctors adjunct faculty.
Yes.
In the medical school, actually.
Well, that's a good possibility, but that'll be a long...
Yes, sure.
It's a long thing before conventional medicine. It's the, you know, the commercial. They're, at the same time, they're spending billions on neuroscientists and machineries and what have you, you know, and chemical things and creating neurotransmitters, SSRI uptake inhibitors, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a little movement like that. That's good, all to the good. And there's some Chinese acupuncture schools that are teaching, trying to implement some sort of teaching of Tibetan medicine in California and Hawaii, but they have a hard time with their own accreditation boards because of Chinese thing about it. It's not, there's no such thing as Tibetan medicine. It's just a version of Chinese medicine, in other words. So, because they're so nervous about that cultural thing. So anyway, so I don't want to get totally lost in that. We come back to the Dharma practice.
This episode is a part of the Tibetan Medicine 101 series, using classic teachings from Robert Thurman's archives to elucidate basic concepts of the tradition. Originally recorded at Menla Retreat in Phoenicia, New York, summer 2014. To watch video versions of classic episodes of the Bob Thurman podcast, please follow Tibet House US on YouTube. And now back to Bob with the second half of this week's episode.
Now, I want to recommend, there. I have a translation here, somewhere, where do I have it, of the work that we worked on in the three sessions that we had. We worked on transcendent renunciation, and we worked on, on page, in my Essential Tibetan Buddhism book, which I think is a good, the introduction to it is one of the best things I wrote introducing Tibetan Buddhism. And then there is a short thing on pages 112 through 114, called The Three Principles of the Path by the Lama Tsongkhapa of the early 15th century, written, said to be kind of dictated to him by Manjushri. And it has in it sort of quintessential, a few verses on each of the three things that we studied, you know, the transcendent renunciation, liberty and opportunity are hard to get. That's the precious human lifetime. And there is no time to life. That's the immediacy of death theme. Keep thinking on this and you will turn off your interest in this life, meaning you will stop being motivated only by what you're going to get out of whatever it is in this life, because assuming that you don't have another one. So those two themes, deeply reflected upon, will help you expand your concern about your evolution to a multiple life one. Then contemplate the inexorability of evolutionary effects. That's the tenfold path, you know, and how one, everything that you do, everything you think, is creating an evolutionary effect which cannot be, which is inexorable, which will have its way. And the sufferings of life, of unenlightened life, over and over again. And you will turn off interest in future lives, that is to say, you will not be motivated just by want to get to heaven in a future life. By constant meditation on these themes, your mind will not entertain a moment's wish, even for the successes of this life, meaning you won't be primarily motivated by the wish for any kind of success in this life. And you will aim for freedom day and night. That will be your main thing, nirvana, in other words. And then you experience transcendent renunciation. So that's the first theme. Then there's another couple of verses on the next one, compassion. It says, transcendence without the spirit of enlightenment cannot generate the supreme bliss of unexcelled enlightenment. And therefore, the bodhisattva conceives the supreme spirit of enlightenment, which by the exchange of self and other method or by this sevenfold cause and effect method. And then there's two verses here which are really nice. Carried away on the currents of four mighty streams, which are the streams of craving, identity, existence, craving for non-existence, actually, nihilistic craving, and one other one, which I forgot. Anyway, tightly bound, and ignorance, I guess, tightly bound by the near inescapable chains of evolution, trapped and imprisoned in the iron cage of self-preoccupation, totally enveloped in the dark of misknowledge, born and born again in endless cyclic lives, uninterruptedly tortured by the three sufferings, suffering of change, which is worldly happiness, suffering of suffering, and suffering of creation. Such is the state of all beings, all just your mothers. From your natural feeling is conceived the highest spirit. That's the wish to be a Buddha for the sake of all beings. Then there's another intermediary verse where it says, though you experience transcendence and cultivate the spirit of enlightenment, so now you have both that wish for freedom and wish to include others in freedom. You have both of those. But without wisdom from realizing voidness, you cannot cut off the root of the cyclic life. So you should strive to realize relativity, which is more or less synonymous with voidness in his teaching, in non-dualistic teaching. And then there's a really amazing bunch of verses that I recommend to you. I mean, you can probably find this online, even you don't have to get this book. But the Three Principles of the Path, and other translations of it too. Who sees the inexorable causality of things, both of cyclic life and of nirvanic liberation, and destroys any objectivity conviction, thus finds the path that pleases Buddhas. Now that's a really good one. So you see, that's the realistic worldview, right? You know, accepts inexorable causality. Even though the liberated state, nirvana itself, is not caused, and non-dualistically it's always been here, nevertheless, the achievement of the understanding of it has a cause, which in the case of, which is removing one's ignorance of it. And so when you see the causality of both your habitual living and also liberative striving, you will get rid of all objectivity convictions. It's a very interesting expression, meaning, you know, rigid attitudes about the absoluteness of this object or that thing or that theory or that belief or the self or whatever it is. You know, that there's some sort of absolute objectivity out there and conviction about that. You will eliminate it, thereby you don't get enlightened, but you enter the path that pleases the Buddha. They are happy when they see someone being more open-minded, in other words. That means. That's the first verse. Then he has the second one. Appearance inevitably relative. That's the relative world, everything totally interrelated. And voidness free from all assertions, or emptiness free from all assertions. That is, you know, emptiness meaning that everything lacks absoluteness. Therefore, anything, any theory you have about anything, or any assertion you have about it, any the way you see it actually is never going to really, you begin to understand it's never going to really correspond to whatever it really is, right? And not just the high idea of voidness, so don't get all like perplexed, oh, this is way over my head, something like that. Remember, I used the analogy of eating an apple, right? In other words, if you have a conviction that this is the most delicious apple that anybody ever ate, and it's exactly what I experience when I eat it, and it's like I can describe it in whatever chemical terms. I mean, the point is no one can describe that experience, but you certainly can have it, right? That's being aware of the emptiness of every kind of perspective on it, which doesn't mean that they're not all useful perspectives in a relative sense, but none of them are the perspective. You follow me? So that's emptiness free of all assertions, or voidness free from all assertions. As long as these are understood apart as two separate things, the Buddha's intention is not well known yet. So in other words, that everything is totally relative, and also that emptiness being the ultimate reality of it, there's no ultimate assertion about it all. There's no theory that captures it. There's no concept that's adequate to it. Right? These are not apart. These are the same thing. There's inexorably relative, and therefore there's no grasping it as this or that. Okay? But when they coincide, not alternating, mere sight of inevitable relativity secures knowledge beyond objectivisms. An investigation of the realistic view is perfect. Okay? So this is what I think I already mentioned to you, the royal reason of relativity. You see things. And even though, you know, if you become a little bit more, meditate more about emptiness and such things, you realize, like, not only about yourself when you're in a towering rage or you're innocently accused or you're righteously indignant or you're righteous simply or you're right. You're right. You got it, you know. Like somebody else is wrong. You know how we get? We get furious. We get stuck, you know. That means that we have this inner absolutism. Okay? So when I'm right and you're wrong, I'm really right. And, you know, I'm not going to back down, all this kind of thing. But, and then if I'm beginning to work in this voidness, emptiness thing, what I then realize is that the fact that I can exaggerate my perception of myself and my rightness and the whatever, my theory and the situation, and blah, 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 makes those things that seem absolute relative because I'm experiencing them. Because I'm feeling so absolute about it. That's a proof and strengthens the relativity of them, which erodes my objectivism about it. You follow me? Acts like a slow balm. You know, it's like you put on an ointment on your poison ivy and it slowly shrinks those bubbles and stops the itching. It doesn't immediately erase and eradicate it, but gradually. This is one of the big delusions about enlightenment that I'm afraid we get a little bit from Zen and Chan in the West, that enlightenment is like nothing happens and then boom, there's like a big explosion. And Atisha, the great master from Bengal and Tibet, said it's like enlightenment is like butter melting in a broth. It's like ironing the wrinkles out of a cotton cloth with a hot stone. They didn't have steam irons. You know, it's like a gradual thing. There will be little spurts of insight and little moments. But enlightenment, I even read something just the other day because I received a monthly magazine. Some guy talking about the state of enlightenment. When you hear from anybody about the state of enlightenment, kill it. Like the Zen people say, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill it. Very rude thing they say.
Yep.
But what they mean is if you're thinking there's some absolute other thing than yourself, that's Buddha, get rid of that concept. That's what they mean. And also, if you think you're absolutely Buddha, get rid of that. Or if you're waiting for a state to take you over, forget about that. Yes, you will have a state of seeming emptiness if you really meditate deeply. It's called a state of where it's like the state of everything seeming to disappear, including yourself. But that's not the ultimate reality. Taratoko brilliantly described it. That is the first step in your understanding that yourself, your absolutized self-centeredness is an error. So your sort of sense of absolute self disappears. And since your sense of absolute self has been cancerously wrapped around your relative sense of living self for so long, when you see it disappear, your relative sense of self also disappears. It's dragged with the absolute one into a seeming as if everything disappears. So you have a momentary experience as if you're not there. Or there is no there, or even something like that. I have a big, what they call space-like equipoise samadhi. Concentration on just a pure spaciousness. But that is not emptiness. Because that state is also empty of any intrinsic or absolute reality itself. It's a temporary state, but very illuminating because it's an antidote. It's kind of like, it's like you've been on a tightrope in life and you had one of those balancing poles, and there's been a very heavy weight balancing on the absolute existence of everything, and that there's no absolute existence of everything has been a dinky little butterfly wing. So you've been like this, trying to balance. And when you have an experience of everything disappearing, suddenly there's a big, heavy, absolute nothingness kind of experience, which is scary even. But when you get past it, you realize it wasn't scary at all because there was no nothing, so you didn't get stuck there. So, but that is often mistaken by people as, and that does sometimes, that experience, you kind of melt into it. And it is a big deal, that experience. It's a very, because it's a counteractor to the everything around me. It's all, this is an absolute object, I'm absolute subject, blah, 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 your habitual behavior. Non-causal, little bit psychotic, psyche and perception. But then the danger of making that into the absolute thing is you can see it in all world mysticisms. And in many people, actually, around. So the dreamlike aftermath samadhi automatically follows it. And then there's some people, there's a kind of oscillation, but other sharper ones will see them interconnected right away. So Dzogchenpa says, appearance inevitably relative, and that includes the appearance of disappearance. The experience of vision might be better, you know, the vision of disappearance. Vision inevitably relative, because vision can be both an object and a subject. The word appearance, maybe I should, it's not good. Appearance is definitely only an object. But vision, you know, you can have a vision and you can have vision or envision something. So vision inevitably relative and voidness free from all assertions. As long as these are understood apart, the victor's intention is not yet known. But when they coincide, not alternating, mere sight, so you know, you somehow begin to develop cognitive dissonance tolerant consciousness, where even though you see something as if it was really real, at the same moment you know it's really not real. And somehow you begin to press these two together and you see them as simultaneously. And this then makes you much more open in connecting to things and seeing other aspects to them, and frees you from conceptual grasping in a certain way. So that's secure knowledge beyond objectivism. Secures your knowledge beyond objectivism, and investigation of the you is perfect. And then this is the second one, is the royal reason of relativity doubled and tripled. It's a double bind, it's a quadruple bind. More, as experience dispels absolutism. So that means you just experience something, even experiencing it habitually as if it had absoluteness in it, you immediately know it's relative. And voidness clears away nihilism, meaning you've had the disappearing experience and you realize it's not nothing. So then you know voidness dawn as cause and effect. So voidness itself, it becomes like the texture or the weave of causality, of relativity. Then you will never be deprived by extremist views. And that's the one I told you, I think, already. I know I did. Where you take your hands like this, you know, church and steeple, turn them inside out, and don't, of course, pull a muscle if you're not a yogi. And do like this, and then, you know, you're sort of locking yourself together. So you, this one, you're pulling one way toward the absoluteness of whatever you see, and you're held the other way by the lack of the absoluteness of its lack of absoluteness, because you've had that experience too. And so the two absolutisms nullify each other, and you have the voidness itself being the cause and effect. And you will never get stuck in any further extremist view. Okay? You got that? I know you do. But you're not satisfied with getting it. You still feel, oh, there's something I'm not quite getting. And that's good. You should keep studying, because it deepens. It's a gradual thing. But once you have it, even on the surface, it's like a slow-acting medicine. Or they even have more insidious things, like a slow poison. It slowly will affect you. Relativity will slowly open your mind and open your connection to things more and more, and get you away from holding them all off with the rigidity of your concepts and your closed-mindedness. Okay? So it's really, this Manjushri is own beautiful thing, this is. So that's that, you know. Then he says, when you realize the essentials of these three principles of the path, rely on solitude. But in your case, you're lay people, you live in society, you have jobs, you have to work, and this and that, and you do a lot of good things, so that's okay. So for you, solitude means having changed your priorities, where your main priority is always the back of your mind. It's always seeing what you can do for liberation. Like, you know, there's a whole treatise like this, where, you know, like when you're sweeping, you just say, okay, I'm sweeping this dust on this floor, but I'm also sweeping the cobwebs out of my mind, the veils that prevent me from realizing emptiness, relativity, indivisible, bliss, void, indivisible, etc., whatever, however you're into approaching it, whatever labels you have for it. You know, voidness, compassion, voidness, the womb of compassion, you know. You're living on the membrane, the nourishing membrane of voidness and compassion. And so rely on solitude and powerful efforts and keep focused on it and swiftly achieve the eternal goal, my child.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzin Shogel. All rights reserved. Used with the artist's permission. To learn more, please visit his website at tenzinshogel.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. To learn about special intensive retreats and programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz thanking you for tuning in this week and reminding you, if you're inspired by our work here, in the work of Tibet House US and Menlo Retreat, please be sure to like, follow, and subscribe on all your favorite social media platforms. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dalek.